Morris and Marilyn Bailey hardly seemed made for each other. He was awkward and plagued by self-consciousness and doubt. She was naturally at ease. She was capable and outgoing. And what brought them together and kept them together was this urge to get out of dreary, ordinary Derby, England. So they dreamed up this project for their lives: save up for a sailboat, quit their jobs, cross the Pacific to New Zealand, and start over. The writer and journalist Sophie Elmhurst says the Baileys poured everything into that boat, all of their energy, all their hopes for a new life. She says it took everything they had. And in March of 1973, they had done it. They were underway.
They've sailed halfway around the world already. Everything has gone incredibly well. They've gone through storms and challenges. It hasn't all been smooth, but they're intact. 3 days into their Pacific crossing, in the middle of the night, Marilyn's up on deck. They take turns on watch. And she sees a sort of lit up fishing boat not that far away, and she's curious about it, wonders what it is, but, you know, everything recedes, they pass by. And she comes to the end of her watch, and she goes downstairs to wake up Morris so they can swap and have breakfast and coffee, when they feel this extraordinary collision. Objects fly across the cabin, cupboard doors open, spoons and cutlery sailing across the room. So it's an enormous shock. And they have no idea at that moment what it is. Up on deck, they discovered the cause. A whale was next to them in the ocean, massive and alive. Water was streaming down the dark cliffs of its body as it twisted and writhed. It looked as if it were trying to climb out of the waves, hauling its dark bulk up, then smashing back down. A meteor landing in the ocean, showering spray. Its tail, 10 feet across the flukes, was beating at the surface in a kind of fury. Blood poured from its body into the water. Marilyn couldn't understand where it had come from. She'd just been up here, waiting for the dawn, and seen nothing but a fishing boat when she'd taken over from Morris at 3. You don't miss a whale. But perhaps you do. He must have risen from the depths just after she'd gone down the ladder and broken the surface right where they were. She couldn't bear the thought they'd somehow hurt the creature. It seemed uncanny that in the entirety of the Pacific, this would be the spot it chose. From the way it's kind of thrashing in the water, and obviously the blood pouring into the water, they realize it's probably in its last stages of life, and they start sort of trying to figure out how this has happened, whether they had caused the injury to the whale, or whether it was actually the boat maybe they'd seen earlier in the middle of the night, whether that was actually a whaling ship that had tried to harpoon the whale. Either way, the whale suddenly disappears below the water and it's gone. And they realize they need to go and check for damage. So they run back down into the cabin from where they come from. And their worst fears are confirmed as soon as they're down there. They realize the water's already rising in the cabin, and they go into sort of emergency mode at that point. They have to figure out how to try and locate the hole, first of all, where the water's obviously coming in, and then to try and figure out how to stop the water coming in and see if they can rescue the boat. Around them, the Pacific was moving gently. Marilyn watched cushions she'd spent hours embroidering float away on the waves. Their boat settled low in the ocean, then lower. Marilyn found her camera and took a picture of Morris, who was sitting in front of her, shirtless. He turned back to look at her, every muscle of his back delineated under the harsh glare of the sun, wearing an expression not of fear, not yet, but of a kind of taut blankness, as if he'd not quite grasped what was taking place, the sight of their boat tipping to one side as she sank in the middle of the ocean. She went down so gracefully. The solid bulk of her hull, the deck, cockpit, sails and ropes, all quietly swallowed by the water. Marilyn took a picture as the last triangle of sail and the tip of the mast disappeared beneath the surface. Frozen in the photograph, the Mars looked as if it might be coming the other way, emerging from the water, like a thin arm, hoping for rescue. I mean, there's something so stark about it, isn't there? And I think there's something particularly stark about the idea of being in this predicament, which is immediately a sort of life or death predicament with your partner, with your spouse. I guess all our relationships face tests, but this is as extreme as it gets. They've done so much already. They've been married for years. They've built this boat. They've gone on, you know, many sort of metaphorical journeys, as it were, to get to this point in their literal journey. And now they're faced with a kind of stripping away of all those things that they had worked towards, you know, done jobs for years to be able to fund this trip, to build this boat. And now that has all gone, and you're left with this sort of absolute bare reality of just you and your partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her new book, A Marriage at Sea, Sophie Elmhurst chronicles what happens next. For 118 days, the Baileys drifted in a small dinghy. She writes about having to endure the sun, about the relentless hunger and thirst, how they managed to capture fish and turtles and rainwater. But it's also a portrait of their relationship, which is complicated, like most relationships. It's love, but it's also codependence and loneliness. Sophie told us it was one of those stories that you stumble upon. During the pandemic, she was interested in people who wanted to ditch it all and head for the water, but she wasn't actually looking for a shipwreck story.
I'm a journalist, so I kind of go down lots of tunnels when I'm researching a piece, and I'd been talking to my editor, and I'd had a story idea about, I'd happened to catch sight of some little nib in a paper or online about the fact that during the pandemic there'd been this uptick in the sale of private islands, obviously to the kind of super rich, I'm guessing, not to your average person. But it just really struck me, like, what that was, you know, what that sort of revealed, I suppose, psychologically about what we were kind of going through in the pandemic. And part of it was, you know, an isolation that everyone was feeling just in their own homes. But part of it was also this lust to kind of escape the feeling of the kind of collective entrapment, I suppose, you know, wherever you lived, your town, your community, or, you know, your country, you know, we couldn't go anywhere. And you couldn't, there was, I suppose, this idea of a greater freedom out on the ocean, or a greater freedom on your own private island, you know, that it might offer that. That sort of just took me down a tunnel, I suppose, of finding lots of stories of people kind of both sort of pre-pandemic and during, of people just trying to kind of get off the land in many different ways. And yeah, some of these are still ongoing, these kind of Bitcoin communities, or, you know, crazy pods in the Pacific Ocean. That, you know, there are all sorts of sort of extraordinary ways that people have tried to do this. It's obviously a very long-standing human urge that what looks like escape, I suppose, but actually I think can often, as in this case, become a sort of prison of its own. And so it was just sort of on that, you know, in the course of that research that I came across this, and it seemed to sort of tap into that same impulse. I think Morris felt that very acutely, that desire to be sort of away from civilization without, you know, as maybe it's impossible to do without ever really realizing the true sort of meaning of that, or the implications of that, if that is realized to the, you know, such an extreme degree as it was in their case.
I mean, what a wonderful surprise it must have felt like to have found it. I mean, it was quite a thing when it happened, but I think people's memories, people's idea of that moment had really subsided. You must have felt like you had found something, like a treasure or something.
Yeah, it did absolutely feel like that. Although at the first I was just sort of bemused or almost disbelieving that it wasn't better known. I kept asking people. I was like, do you remember the story? Like, this happened only in the 70s and was an English couple, you know, and, you know, my mom, or, you know, had plenty of relations of that generation who I sort of thought, oh, well, they would all know this story very well. But very few people that I've met remember it in a kind of a sort of smaller sailing community, you know, people who are real, or especially among the kind of, you know, the circumnavigators, you know, they're quite a sort of elite sailing club, I suppose. Then their stories are fairly legendary, I think, and people remember their book, their version of it. But beyond that, I think it is, you know, broadly forgotten. I don't think anyone knows then, remembered their names or really what had happened to them, or the, just the extent of it. You know, it's so extraordinary, the length of time that they were adrift in the Pacific and sort of, you know, quickly kind of, I suppose, confirm that sense of its specialness when I realized how forgotten it was, and how I'm sure everyone would react to it in the same way that I would, which was sort of wonder and mystification that, you know, they hadn't known of it before, basically.
Let's talk about Morris and Marilyn. But I guess before we get there, I did want to ask, how do you describe your relationship now with them? I mean, like, the way you feel about having now spent so much time trying to understand them and write about them. How do you describe... Yeah, like, do you feel like you know them in some way?
Yeah, it's such a good question. It's a question I find really interesting on lots of levels, and I find it interesting as a journalist as well. You know, what your relationship is to your subjects, and what you owe them, and what your sort of ethical duty is to them. And I'm used to writing about living people, you know, and being able to talk to them, and the complexities of that, by the way, you know, of like how you represent someone who's then going to read what you've written, and. Yeah. How they respond to that. But this was a different challenge, one that I hadn't, you know, embarked on before, where obviously my subjects were no longer alive. And in a kind of awful but good way as a writer, that's quite liberating, because I sort of, you know, knew they couldn't object. But at the same time, I felt that even deeper sense of, I suppose, duty to be faithful to them, I suppose, and to, I suppose, be respectful, to try and really capture them as truthfully as I could, while knowing that in some of those depictions, maybe particularly of Morris, who I grew incredibly fond of, as much as he was a difficult person to spend, you know, 2 or 3 years with on the page, you know, it was quite a lowering experience at times. But I was very, very fond of him, and got to know him in a way which I think is obvious in the book. I got to know him better than Marilyn. There was more of him on the page that, you know, existed than there was of her. And so I felt like I could sort of inhabit, you know, in his mind and his language. His voice was louder, I guess. But, you know, I know that in the resulting portrait, and from having spoken to lots of people about him and got lots of impressions of him, you know, it's not always flattering at all. And he, there are plenty of people who have read this book and are like, God, Morris, like, you know, I can't deal with this guy. But I didn't feel like that. And I hope, I don't know, I've often asked myself the question, you know, what would he feel in response to this? How would he have dealt with this process? I think he might have, you know, he was quite a controlling man and a writer himself. So he would have, I think, been quite disconcerted by the thought of someone else telling the story. But I hope in the long run he might have seen it as a fair, and I hope a kind of, and a rejuvenating kind of depiction of their story, that it would reach, you know, more people than I think he always wanted it to reach people.
When we first meet Morris in the book, he's working in this print shop in the town of Derby. Didn't really like the place, or didn't really care for what he did professionally. You know, it was a job. It was nothing more. He's so interesting, Morris. He has a terrible sense of self-esteem. You say when he was a teenager, he couldn't bear himself. There's something really sad about him, not bitter or cruel, although there are moments when you wonder if he's a misanthrope, but like it just seems to come down to just he couldn't stand himself for some reason.
Yeah, I think it does. A lot of it comes down to that. He did say that himself. You know, he didn't ever really talk about his family to anyone, but there are these little passing moments which you feel like open this great sort of truth. You know, which is the idea that one of them being when he says that. Until he met Marilyn, he didn't really know what affection was. I think that gives you a fairly clear insight into what his upbringing was like, or how he felt within his family. He was, you know, one of four kids. You know, it wasn't that sort of demonstrative affection just wasn't sort of done then. Yeah. But I think there was also a fair amount of pressure and religious pressure. And he was also very unwell as a child, and lonely as a child as a result, you know, and had various struggles. I think, you know, sort of physical over time, that, you know, all those things mark a kid, right? They sort of isolate you, and they stay with you. You know, we sort of superficially grow out of our childhoods, I guess, but they're lurking within, I think. And I think for Morris, they really were. I think he kind of got out as soon as he could and was always trying to escape, you know.
And never looked back.
Yeah, but I think he couldn't escape himself. And I suppose that was always what I felt was his great tragedy, in a way, was that in all his sort of escape attempts, what he was really trying to get away from was himself. Or desperately wanting to be different. Yeah.
I mean, he's sort of living this, you know, really ordinary existence in Derby, but he has these hobbies that give him a sense of freedom. I mean, he climbs rocks, he flies planes, he, you know, lifts weights. It's interesting. You say that his existence for years, as you put it, alone in the stubborn sort of way that lodges in people when they can't imagine sharing their lives with someone else.
Yeah, I think that is genuinely how he felt. I think he was quite a resigned sort of bachelor, as I suppose they called it then. And he lived alone, he worked, and he had these sort of quite entrenched hobbies and patterns to his life. But I think he'd always been clear, you know, it was very clear to him that he would never wanted children, but I don't think he thought he was sort of capable of a relationship. I don't think he thought that was within him until he met Marilyn. And I think that's often true of many people. They can't imagine being with someone for the rest of their lives until they meet the person. But I think in Morris, it was more of an extreme case. It wasn't just that he couldn't imagine sort of being in a long-term relationship. I don't think he thought he was capable, you know, that it wasn't something that was within him.
And this gets us to Marilyn. I mean, because the relationship is so interesting, and just in the sense that doesn't it all seem that he would be suited to her? I mean, when we meet her in the book, Morris has met her at this car rally that he went to in Derby, and she has such an ease about her. I mean, as he noticed, she knew how to do things. She has this composure or this confidence. And the confidence part seems not at all in keeping with, you know, who Morris is. How do you understand that connection?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is quite mystifying. I mean, I think it was mystifying to people close to them as well, and remained quite mystifying. You know, I mean, not to put too fine a point in it, I think what was mystifying was what she saw in him. And you know, I think that's her sister, you know, who I spoke to, sort of was still wondering about that, really. But I think there was also, you know, which I tried to sort of excavate in a bit in the book, although it's fairly speculative, I suppose. But I think she was from a generation, you know, we're talking this sort of 60s when she's kind of coming of age and you know, a young adult. And she was living alone, you know, she was an only child of her parents. And it was a very limited and conventional, and the expectations for her were both limited and conventional. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the society they were in. And she obviously had this kind of innate spirit and this spirit of adventure and a sort of very, you know, energized and positive outlook. And she, I think, sort of had sort of larger ambitions for her life. You know, she didn't want to conform, and she wasn't a conformer. Yeah. She didn't want to do all the things that her peers were doing, going to these dances at the barracks and worrying about what they were going to wear and, you know, the latest fashions or whatever. That wasn't her bag. And she had other ideas. And I think through Morris, those other ideas kind of came alive, or he gave them shape, I think, because she didn't even, you know, she'd never done any of these things before. She'd never gone off hiking in the Lake District and wild camping, and, you know, whether it's the planes or the boats or all these different things that he opened up to her, this was all very new and very exciting. So I think, as much as he was this kind of, you know, as a character kind of feels like quite sort of heavy and closed, he actually was accessing a large and open world. And I think she sort of saw that and wanted to follow him there.
Well, he did get a sense they were, despite the differences, kindred spirits in a way, both wanting to escape, to get out of that kind of drab existence where they were.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it clearly worked. It clearly, you know, worked a long term. You know, they stayed married for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from multiple sort of friends and relations, it was clear that she was the driving force. She kind of made their plans. She made things happen. She was the sort of motivating energy of the relationship. And that clearly worked for both of them. You know, that's not to say that he was weak by any means. You know, he was a powerfully and exhaustingly opinionated man, and they would have furious rows about, you know, very minor things. But for whatever reason, in the mystery of all these, of all relationships, that there's sort of the dynamic between them, and I suppose the power dynamic, you know, if you see all relationships and marriages as some form of power dynamic, there seemed to work. And I think one of the reasons it worked particularly well was that she held a lot of the power, and he was sort of willing, you know, and supportive of that at a time when, you know, not many men necessarily or automatically were.
Sophie Elmhurst. Her new book is called A Marriage at Sea, A True Story of Love, Obsession, and Shipwreck. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're hearing the remarkable story of a shipwreck in 1973. The writer and journalist Sophie Elmhurst says it's surprising more people don't know about this story. A British couple were crossing the Pacific when a dying sperm whale rammed into their sailboat and sunk it. So for 118 days, they managed to survive in this inflatable dinghy. They lived on rainwater and raw fish and turtles, and they drifted like 1,500 miles. But Elmhurst's book is about more than just survival. It's an exploration of the dynamics of partnership and love in the face of this unbelievable journey. The book is called A Marriage at Sea. How does this idea of getting a boat come to them? It's not just a boat, we should mention, of course, is a hobby. I mean, they wanted – it was like kind of a getaway vessel. Like they wanted to live on it. This was their project, their life project.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a sort of tearing up of their former life.
Yeah.
I mean, it started with an idea to emigrate, to move to a different country, that is New Zealand, which felt, compared to England, you know, wild and unpopulated, and where they could have a bunch of really different existence, you know, literally on the other side of the world from where they'd grown up and where their families were. But then I think it was that place combined with this idea that they could sail there. And, you know, Marilyn absolutely was the sort of the kind of driver of this. I think he sort of thought it was sort of harebrained in a way, or kind of just so extreme as an idea that they would sell everything they own, you know, down to the last item of furniture, and build this boat and just start a new life. You know, it was a very risky act, and I think Morris was fundamentally a very cautious man, and so that's where she brought her own sort of style of adventure, I suppose, to the relationship. And you know, it was a sort of total reimagining of what life could be and would be for them, and it absolutely abandoned all the sort of norms and conventions of the time, and still now, you know, I think still if someone said to you now they were selling everything they owned and their home and embarking on a round the world trip to live in another country, well, you know, that would still feel like quite a kind of a bold and extreme act, I think. So you can only sort of imagine, I suppose, the degree to which it was then.
I think one of the more striking parts of the story is just how completely and utterly prepared they were for a disaster. I mean, how careful and intent they were about building that boat and kitting it out. And also you get a sense of like it was expensive. It was incredible. And it took years and years for them to – I mean, when it goes down, you get a sense. I mean, you refer to it as having – they had the sense of it being their baby. And just how intent they were on getting it put together, that was really – kind of remarkable how prepared they wanted to be.
Yeah, I mean, obsessionally so. And this is a lot. This is very Morris. You know, it's the strange. I mean, it's something that, you know, I've never been sailing, so it's a mysterious world to me. But I talk to a lot of people about it, and you know, a lot of sailors, and I think it contains this wonderful contradiction, which I found, I suppose, sort of psychologically very interesting. That, you know, in the idea of it, as it was to Morris, it's this form of freedom and escape. But in the practical sort of reality of it, it's minutiae and technicalities and dogged preparations and really specific measurements. And, you know, he would literally kind of fit out the whole galley and then sort of, you know, he would build something and then take it apart and rebuild it. You know, he was constantly working on it and maintaining it and checking and rechecking and making lists. And, you know, it was I think this is, you know, a sort of not uncommon, although he probably took it to an extreme, but that kind of level of control and detail and sort of technical skill is what is required, especially if you're doing a voyage like this. So it's sort of all the kind of greater irony, I suppose, when everything goes wrong and the boat sinks and they, you know, they salvage what they can, but various things are sort of, you know, missing, you know, of all these sort of careful and, you know, finely tuned plans and preparations. You know, most of them sink below the Pacific Ocean and they're left kind of scrabbling and having to use intuition and imagination and all sorts of sort of other things, which were not Morris's strengths and more Marilyn's strengths to survive. And I suppose it's the ultimate challenge, isn't it, to the kind of micro organizer and the obsessive planner, is when it all literally sinks before your very eyes and you have to start again.
Say something about this book that became kind of, you described it as the sacred text for Morris anyway. It's a book called Voyaging Under Sail by Eric Hiscock. It was kind of their guide or his guide for the project.
Yeah, I mean, he referred to it a lot, and it was one of the books they had on the boat. And he was a sort of famous sailor at the time and had done this circumnavigation with his wife and written this very detailed sort of guide, essentially. But as with a lot of these sorts of things, you know, it kind of reminds me of certain kind of gardening books or cookery books, you know, where it's a sort of like it all has, where you're sort of being told by an authority, you know, how something should be in its ideal form. And it has that sort of slightly strange effect making you feel quite sort of inadequate, or at least there's a very high standard that you have to adhere to, I think, to make it work, and all these things you have to do. And it's quite instructional, I suppose, in tone. And, you know, I think that appealed to Morris a lot, you know, that it was sort of the way he operated as well. But there was this concept that kept coming up in the book, which is about sort of the idea of being seaman-like, and, you know, what is the sort of expected behavior of a captain particularly, but just anyone on board a ship, and you know, everything that sort of happened to them, I think sort of must, you know, challenged Morris's idea of himself, you know, as someone who was expertly seaman-like. Usually, you know, he was often helping other people out on their boats and knew exactly how to sort of prepare a boat in harbor if there was going to be a huge storm, and, you know, was absolutely committed to his anti-fouling, you know, and all these things you have to do on a boat, he would do to the sort of nth degree. But then, you know, once everything's, you know, gone and sunk, it's sort of the ultimate, it's like an existential challenge, I think, really, to the idea, his idea of himself as a captain and as a competent person. And I think he was sort of felt like it wasn't just a, you know, it felt like an exposure of his incompetence. And it, I guess, went back to that sort of childhood feeling of just a failure, really, and of sort of not being good enough, and of having, you know, not done what he was supposed to do. In a long passage on the importance of vigilance, Hiscock chastised himself for the time he nearly wrecked his boat when he failed to check the location of a light as he approached the Panama shore. It was his own fault. His approach had been unseamanlike. There was simply nothing worse on a boat than a captain being unseamanlike. It was like an army officer betraying cowardice. So how did you become seamanlike, this elusive, essential quality? Yes, it would accrue through experience, Morris knew, and involved skill, learning, and a common-sense intelligence. But there also seemed to be something more fundamental at play. It appeared to reflect character. In a crisis at sea, there isn't time to ponder or deliberate. You can't be defeatist. Things go wrong, and even great sailors make mistakes. People get tired or overconfident. Their judgment skews. You have to adapt. You need to know what to do and how to do it in an instant, to act with a kind of light, unthinking instinct, the way a dancer might shift position mid-flight. It sounded, worryingly for Morris, close to an art.
Let's talk about the plan for crossing the Pacific, the wreck itself, which you already sort of took us through the morning. But give us a sense of where they are. They're not far from where they're headed. So give us a little perspective of where they are at this moment.
So but they think, I mean, if they've been continuing, they thought it was about 10 days more sailing, which isn't very much. It's not the longest part of the crossing by any means, I think, from Panama to the Galapagos. And so, you know, it was sort of tantalizingly close in a way. And when the boat first went down, they sort of thought, well, they tried to row there. They had oars in the dinghy, and it seemed like it would be possible if they could, you know, just sort of keep going for long enough. But as it is, obviously, always more complicated than that. You know, there are currents and wind, which were pushing them off course, and further away, you know, it just was never going to work. You know, and it was also sort of, I suppose, reflective of the times they were in. I mean, well, two points to make there. One, you know, there wasn't GPS. There was nothing like that. They told various people where they were going, but no one expected to hear from them for a very long time because they were crossing the Pacific. You never know if you're going to see someone in the next port or not. You know, no one expected to possibly see them, you know, again for weeks or even months. So there was no sort of urgency to their absence or to their silence. And then the other point being that Morris had refused to take a radio on board or any kind of, you know, radio communication device. So he wanted that sort of perfect isolation. That was part of his sort of fantasy of escape. It meant they just had absolutely no way of communicating sort of beyond themselves. So while they were sort of in a way kind of strangely close to land and to civilization, they were also as far from it as, you know, they could possibly be.
You mentioned early on Morris is working through these deep feelings of being a failure. And it's so interesting when you write about how each of them kind of worked out how they thought about their chances. Morris figures they're doomed. He doesn't say it out loud. But he thinks, like, what's the point in some ways? He's very logical. He's thinking it out. But talk about that just in terms of in contrast to the way Marilyn is thinking about all of that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you see the sort of, as you do in Crisis, the sort of diametric difference in the attitudes and in their psychology is, you know, almost immediately. I mean, very quickly, Morris is thinking of ways that they can kill themselves and yeah. is sort of just assuming that this is, you know, they haven't got a chance. They're not going to be able to row there. They're not going to be able to contact anyone. That it's very unlikely that someone's going to go past and see them. And so it's really a question of when they'll die and how, and whether they do it themselves or not. And man, it's not just that she doesn't sort of allow these thoughts to enter their head. It's like she would never, her whole tilt of her sort of mind is towards sort of solution and possibility and hope. And it's almost, I mean, as he sometimes felt, that it was almost sort of delusional, the degree to which she would hold on to the idea yeah. of the idea that they were going to survive, you know, in the face of sort of all arguments to the contrary or evidence to the contrary. But, you know, even in moments of real despair and depression, which she does have, you know, she records them in her diary, especially when ships do start to go past and, you know, many of them do and never stop and don't see them. And she does have these sort of real lows, but she never really lets go of the idea and almost like a certainty of the fact that they will survive and they will be able to sort of tell the story and tell their friends, you know, what they did and saw. And I don't know, when I was sort of like, it became one of the most interesting sort of studies for me, I suppose, that the idea of that, yeah, that that's a different response and what shapes that. And, you know, it's crudely, it's, you know, a pessimist versus an optimist, but I think it's more, you know, more complicated than that. I became very interested in the idea of how the imagination works in these moments and in these situations. And I, you know, it's as much to do with sort of realism and fantasy almost, in that what she was able to do was conjure fantasies essentially that sustained them or sustained her, and she could by turn sustain him. And those were fantasies of the future, of whether it was meals she wanted to make or dresses she wanted to sew or the next boat they were going to build. And, you know, he just didn't have that, you know, it's like the gift of imagination was just not available to him. He could only kind of go, he was completely limited by the sort of the stark reality that we're surrounded by. And it's a real lesson in that I think something's being limited by reality, you know, or what you can't imagine can be, can have a very detrimental effect, essentially, that hope is essentially a work of imagination and has no basis in reality at all, really. Whatever you're hoping for, it is a fiction, but that fiction sustains us.
I think it's so interesting that Marilyn compiles this inventory of everything they had. Right. And it's really powerful to see it laid out on the page. But it's also, she creates these menus. We see that on the page. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that part. And say something about her diary. I mean, the Spanish filmmaker Alvaro Cerezo saw the diary, I guess. Morris gave it to him, and he photographs every page, and so I guess you've seen it, you've looked at it, because it adds such another dimension to the story.
Yeah, it does. I mean, anyone can look at it. It's online. It's yeah. I mean, it's a sort of gift that both Morris and Alvaro kind of gave. When I first saw it, and he sent me the sort of original photographs, because it's quite hard to transcribe, and I transcribed it all. And there are these moments of real sort of wonder and fascination, especially I found actually. Some of those lists and drawings that she does. And that's partly why those were the drawings are often of, like, she'll draw a little cartoon of a cat, or she'll design herself a little skirt and a top or a dress. And I found those very moving, those little kind of moments of almost like her just distracting herself from the situation she's in. But it's also in contrast in a way to the words. And of course, when you find something like that as a writer, you're like, this is, you know, gold. I've got a whole diary of this year that they were shipwrecked. But actually, a lot of Marilyn's words are quite limited. You know, a lot of the entries are quite stark, quite factual, quite brief. You know, when she is in the sort of depths, what sounds like clearly a sort of terrible moment when, you know, Morris is ill and the ship's just gone past and they're running, you know, the water's spoiled or whatever, you know, a series of disastrous events, you know, she'll just write, you know, cold and wet, you know, depressing, using, you know, and it'll be very sort of blunt and short. And you don't really feel like through her words that you're getting this sort of, I suppose, insight into her, you know, deepest sort of or more secret thoughts or some more intimate thoughts. But I feel like what you do get through these other things, through these you know, whether it's these menus that she's writing, which are for sort of elaborate dinner parties or lunch parties or tea parties or cake lists of cakes and sandwiches and every flavor of, you know, sandwich or cake that you can possibly imagine. You know, what you get when you read those is just this idea of this frenetic kind of, yeah, sort of fantasizing mind. You know, and for obviously for lots of reasons, you know, the darker reason is obviously they're starving to death, you know, quite rapidly. They're eating raw fish, a diet of raw fish, essentially, and turtle, and that's about it. And they're sort of wasting away. But you also get this idea of, like I was saying, that sort of hopeful side of fantasy, which is her dreaming up these kind of fantasy scenarios and meals, you know, these things that she will enjoy again. And she sort of imagines them in order to kind of make them real, I think, in her mind, or to make, to sort of give her something to look forward to hold on to. You know, yeah. It's childish in some ways, that kind of way you fantasize as a child about something delicious or something you want that you can't get, or, you know, but in a way you realize how, you know, that sustains childhood sometimes, doesn't it? Those wishes and those dreams. And I think that was what was sustaining her in these moments.
Sophie Elmhurst. Her new book is called A Marriage at Sea, A True Story of Love, Obsession, and Shipwreck. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Sophie Elmhurst. We're talking about the incredible story of the shipwreck of Morris and Marilyn Bailey in 1973. They were stranded in the Pacific for 118 days after a huge sperm whale took out their sailboat. Her book is called A Marriage at Sea. I want to ask about Morris and the way he would talk about the experience that he and Marilyn had in the raft. After, of course, they were rescued, when a whale appeared. It's just a beautiful moment. And it's such an interesting, talk about contrast and contradiction. A whale takes down their boat. And then they have this other experience that's so lovely. Do you mind reading that?
On the 14th of March, as they were sheltering in the raft, they heard a rush of air like something taking off. Marilyn poked her head out, and there was a whale, 20 feet behind them. Morris felt strangely calm. There was nothing he could do, he knew. They were at its mercy. From the entrance of the raft, they watched it, but they were able to see only a portion of its body framed in the raft's doorway, ribs visible through its shining black skin. It reminded Marilyn of a cow. The blowhole was almost close enough to touch. When it opened slowly, a great cloud of droplets burst into the air and rained down on them in the raft. Morris took Marilyn's hand. If the whale struck the raft and they capsized, he whispered, he might struggle to rescue her. Hold on to the robes. Marilyn nodded. They sat there, silent, the whale peaceful and still. What was it doing? Monitoring their movements or keeping them company, perhaps? It wasn't really their question to ask. They were the ones trespassing. After what felt like hours but was only minutes, they saw its bulk surge forward and down. Don't dive now, whispered Marilyn, worried the sudden movement would capsize them. The whale dived, but cleanly, the black flukes of its tail suddenly high and dark against the sky, then sliding below the surface without a splash.
You mentioned toward the end of the book how Morris brings this up out of nowhere with Alvaro. And it's beautiful, of course, the way he talks about it. And you say something happens to his face when he remembers that whale. Do you mind saying something about that?
Well, this it's from this interview that we spoke about Alvaro that he filmed with Morris. And it's not that long before he dies. He's an old man. He's been also widowed. You know, he's been on his own for a long time. Marilyn died many years before him. It's been a very, you know, long and prolonged grief. And I've often sort of thought about it as the sort of second shipwreck of the book, I guess, is Morris without Marilyn. And there's this moment in when he's asking him about their time adrift and about their time on the raft and, you know, whether he'd do it again. And sort of amazingly, Morris says, yes, you know, if he knew they were going to be rescued, he would, because there was just something, you know, very true, very, very beautiful, very, well, like we were saying, a kind of very pure in the experience. And it was exactly, in a way, that, you know, an extreme version of exactly the experience that he wanted, which was this idea of being sort of separate and away and in his own little kind of world with his wife, you know, but immersed in nature. And that's what he describes, yeah, as you say, that this moment with the whale again. And just being, I think, you know, what is really strikes him is this, the proximity is being so close you can almost touch, that you can see the eye, and that you just get, you know, you have the privilege as a human being of just being in the company of a creature to, you know, that close and so intimately, because they're just in a little raft, you know, they're not on a kind of special whale watching, you know, vessel. You can see he has tears in his eyes as he's remembering this. And it's, I think, you know, as I watched it, and it's my interpretation, I suppose, but it's obviously such a vivid memory for him. You can see him seeing it in his mind's eye. And I guess part of what memory does in that those moments is sort of give you that almost strange, you know, deceptive but compelling idea that it's still going on, that, you know, a very vivid memory like that you can access. The people in it are alive too, you know, and that often that's with, I suppose, are the closest people that we've lost, or the people that we've loved and lost, that in particular memories, in particular moments, they can almost feel alive again.
Sophie, how close do you figure they came, Morris and Marilyn, to dying?
Oh, unbelievably close. I'm amazed that they were, I mean, especially Morris, I'm amazed he was alive when they were eventually rescued. He'd been very unwell. The issues that he had, you know, he had this sort of an infection in his lung that caused him problems for years and years afterwards. He had all these sores, some salt water sores in his body, you know, which is, again, incredible that they hadn't got infected, and, you know, they hadn't got a sort of, and never mind the fact they were emaciated, you know, they were essentially sort of starving. And I imagine that he would have died first and very soon. You know, I think it must have been very, very close, and probably only thanks to her attention and ensuring that he stayed conscious and eating and drinking what he could. But, you know, they were so regularly also just getting sick from what they were able to eat and drink, you know, a bad fish or a bad, you know, water that got contaminated, that often that didn't help either. So it's extraordinary to me that it lived long enough to be rescued, because I think it can't have been long at all.
We don't need to give everything away about them being rescued. I mean, it's a beautiful part of the story, of course. But I did want to say that when it does happen, you know, a ship finally does notice them there, that Morris had to, you know, he had come to think that they, like, what's the point of us even shouting or waving our hands when these ships do come? Because, and this is interesting how you put it in the book, this is our world now. This is where we belong. Now, he's not thinking entirely rationally, but just explain what's happening there. It's almost like they've settled into that existence, and he's sort of given way to what's probably going to, what he thinks anyway, is going to happen to them.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think they both sort of had different reactions to the same sensation, which is of these ships going past and not seeing them. And she has a kind of defiance, but yeah, sort of like, okay, well, if you're not going to see me, then we don't care about you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you don't get to have the power over me, basically,
right,
and you're going to make me feel bad about this. We don't want you either.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
we'll be fine. And I think his version of that is, as always, with all of these things, is slightly indifferent. You know, I think that those are the, in a way, his most sort of positive moments, these moments of sort of where he's not so sick or so desperate or so despairing that he can sort of see and sort of wonder at this world in which they found themselves, you know, and this sort of almost feeling like a sort of sea creature, you know, almost feeling at one with the ocean. And part of me wonders whether he was only really able to sort of see it in such kind of poetic and positive terms after the event. You know,
yeah,
I think some of that comes from his sort of retellings of the story that he does afterwards, both in his book and in these letters afterwards. And, you know, he prided himself on his writing, and it was a very important part of his later life, especially once he was on his own. I think it became a very important sort of scaffolding in his life, was to be able to write about his past, a sort of survival tactic almost after he'd lost Marilyn.
I wanted to ask about what seemed to me to be a kind of underlying theme. Maybe that's not right, but loneliness. This sort of brings us back to Marilyn, and we were talking earlier about how she would write, you know, lists and menus, and you write about how she would write letters It was, as you say, the sort of the closest she would come to talking to someone else, someone who wasn't, you know, Morris there. And the larger theme of loneliness I wanted to ask you about. But there's a section I wondered if you wouldn't mind reading about the letters.
It's possible to write yourself out of loneliness. Possible, too, to write yourself into being. As her body shrank, Marilyn built herself out of words sentence by sentence. When she noted the happenings of the day, however bleak, the day was proven to be real and her faculties intact. The writing was the proof. The list, the menus, and the clothes were reminders that such things still existed. Solid things on solid ground that she could make with her own hands. She was still alive. Look, it said so on the page. If any of her papers got wet, she'd spend hours drying them in the sun, handling them with the kind of care usually reserved for ancient texts, or as if they contained some vital formula, whose loss would be incalculable.
The writer Rachel Aviv said that you described your book as being mysterious about fate and marriage, but it also said it was the kind of loneliness that is honored, is how she put it, and nourished rather than avoided. Will you say something about that finally? Does that seem right, the idea of the loneliness that you get at in that relationship and in this story?
I don't know. It interests me a huge amount as a subject, loneliness, and I think there's something about it being a condition of some people's lives that, you know, sometimes it's a state that we fall into through event, you know, whether it's the loss of someone that you love or a partner or, I don't know, the isolation that you know, of a pandemic or, you know, the loss of a job. You know, there are all sorts of, you know, sort of scenarios, I suppose, that can engender loneliness. But I also think, and I think especially if you felt lonely as a child, that it can be a kind of almost like a condition of mind or a habit of mind that you can be constantly in company and yet still feel lonely, and that it can be a condition of a bad relationship as well. I think that people, you can feel, you know, you're most lonely when you're with the wrong person, even if, you know, you're sharing a bed with them or whatever. Like it's something that I think can be an internal state, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say, not one that is just sort of based on whether you're with people externally, with people or not, or in company or not. And I think Morris was a sort of classic case of that, you know, where Marilyn would have felt the intense isolation of being in the ocean. He felt that sort of isolation on and off throughout his life. And in a way, what he returns to at the end is really just sort of the point at which he started, which is that feeling of being at odds with society, of being at odds with people, of not being able to communicate himself or to understand what they're saying. You know, this something always being kind of lost in translation with him, which is an intense sort of form of loneliness. And I think, you know, Rachel Fee's quote was beautiful. I wish, you know, it sort of puts it much better than I think I ever do in the book or could now. But I sort of, like, you know, in a way, I don't know if I'd even sort of noticed that or done that and sort of tried to explore that intentionally, although that made me think of a bit towards the end, where, again, in that Alvaro interview where Morris is talking and you know, Alvaro asks him about, you know, how he feels and whether he's lonely. And he sort of says, yeah, I'm lonely, but I'm sort of used to being, you know, that it can be, he says, I'm used to it now, you know, that's how I've always been, or how, you know, that's a natural kind of condition of the loss of his wife, basically, a natural consequence. And in a way that you don't always, and it's probably the most sensible way to be around it, is in some ways is that you, it's an acceptance of it, I suppose, in that sense. It's maybe not a celebration, certainly, because it's obviously he's in pain, a man in great pain, but it's an acceptance that is the sort of natural result of a loss of that magnitude. But yeah, I think for some people, the idea of loneliness being anything but a sort of horrifying kind of negative state to something that you desperately want to escape, or, you know, I think it would seem very strange, the idea that it might be something that you could kind of learn to live with or accept or even sort of, I don't know, inhabit. But people have to, you know, lots of people do all the time, and doesn't mean it's not painful, but I guess it's how you live alongside that pain, I suppose.
Sophie Elmhurst, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sophie Elmhurst. Her new book is called A Marriage at Sea, A True Story of Love, Obsession, and Shipwreck. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on YouTube at KUER90.1, on Instagram at Radio West. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Aidan Oneida is our intern. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.